Welcome to Economy and Psychology, A Tale of Two Depressions. My name is Betsy Avila. I'm the Executive Director for Democracy at Work, and we advocate for worker cooperatives as a foundation for a more democratic and cooperative economy. Please visit our website at democracyatwork.info. I'm really glad to facilitate this panel and topic. So what is the relation between the economy and our psychological well-being? Most Americans have never recovered from the recession of 2008 and the outsourcing and automatization of their jobs. Americans are still economically and emotionally depressed, and this has caused a rise in increased serious societal ills, declining health and rising obesity rates, suicide, social anxiety, and substance abuse and dependency. Men's salaries and working conditions have been deteriorating since the mid-1970s. Women's salaries have increased to 77% of men's lowest salaries. Suicide rates in the United States, a figure long associated with unemployment, are the highest they have been in 30 years. The United States consumes 50% of the world's psychiatric meds and 80% of the world's heroin substances. While the mainstream media has announced the economic crisis as over, too many remain in misery and despair. This panel explains what happened, why it happened, and what to do about it. So I'm excited to introduce Dr. Harriet Fraud and Professor Richard Wolff. And what I'd like to do is read their biographies before they make each statement, so it's fresh in everybody's minds. And then they'll collectively answer some questions that we have about the topic, and if time allows, we'll have an audience Q&A as well. So I would first like to introduce Professor Richard Wolff. He teaches economics at the New School University and is the host of Economic Update with Richard Wolff, a project of Democracy at Work, now syndicated on 85 stations across the United States and available as a video broadcast on YouTube. His latest book, Capitalism's Crisis Deepens, was released last year, and you can learn more on his website, rdwolf.com. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming. I'm going to be talking a little bit about depression, and I will try not to depress you in the process of doing that. But if in case I do, just remember that the situation I'm describing is not my fault. And I'm just the messenger. And you remember the very famous admonition, don't shoot the messenger if you don't like the message. Okay. I believe there's a close interrelation and interdependence between psychological depression and economic depression. Or to be very precise, each is both the cause and the effect of the other. You don't get one without the other, and if you get either, you get the other. That's what I mean. And it is a urgently important topic, made all the more urgent by the fact that in the half of that equation that I've spent my life in, economics, a weird schizophrenia operates, for those of you who've ever studied the subject. On the one hand, the psychological consequences of economic reality are systematically ignored. They're not counted, they're not evaluated, they play no role. It's as if the psychological dimensions of our lives, which I assume in an audience like this, you all know are serious, serious shapers of the life you lead. It's as if they weren't there. The person who is presented at the beginning of an economics course in the United States is a person who makes calculations about the relative utility they derive from all the possible objects of consumption. It is a person who weighs the costs and benefits of buying or selling a product against holding on to the money. The psychological meaning of money does not enter. The psychological meaning of parting with money does not enter. The psychological impact on you of watching other people consume does not enter. When you finish understanding early in the semester what is assumed to be the behavior and rationale of a human being, the only rational response is to walk out of the room and commit yourself to studying other subjects that are not as lunatic as that one. So imagine the difficulty I have of having spent a life in that profession, whose most basic assumptions strike me as crazy. But the way out of that is then to try, which is what I'm about to try to do, to integrate what has been kept or wrenched apart in such an artificial and inhumane way. So let me begin. Over the last 40 years, roughly since the end or the middle of the 1970s, the American economy has functioned in a way, to make the long story short, to depress the majority of our people. And I mean that in the psychological sense. What is it about the last 40 years that has depressed Americans? Well, let's start. First of all, over the last 40 years, the average wages of an American worker have stayed the same. Or to use the language of economics, they have been stagnant. What do I mean? Very precise. We keep elaborate statistics of what the average wages are that are paid to an American worker. High paid, low paid, and in between. We get an average. We then keep track year after year. By the way, the government does this, and private institutions also do it. We keep track over the 40 years of how much money an average worker got. And then we also keep track of what the average prices were that people paid for whatever they used their wages for. Food, clothing, shelter, transportation, education, medical care, you know, what you all spend your money on. And from that, we get a statistic called the real wage. And all that is the amount of money you got adjusted for the prices you have to pay. So, for example, if your wages doubled, but the prices of everything you bought doubled, you were not ahead at all. Because at the end of this period, you couldn't buy any more with twice your wages than what you were able to buy at the beginning with half of what your twice wages were. In other words, nothing really happened. A real wage that goes up means that the prices don't go up as much as the wages, so you really can buy more. Adjusting wages for prices, and this is really important, the average American worker can't buy any more stuff today than he or she could 40 years ago. That's a staggering statistic anywhere on the world stage. To give you an idea, Chinese workers, and some of you are interested in the People's Republic of China, Chinese workers over the same 40-year period saw their wages go up, real wages, 20 times. If you want to understand the difference between where the Chinese economy is and where the American economy is, just think about that. But that's not my concern. I'm not interested today in China. I want to talk about America. It's also staggering in America. Why? Because up until the 1970s, as far back as we have any statistics for, which is about 1820, I mean, the statistics aren't that great since 1820, but they're completely useless before that. Because we didn't keep the records, it's nobody's fault, it's just the records weren't kept. Since 1820, though, we have a pretty good idea that we can be confident that real wages in America went up every decade compared to what they were before. So let's be sure we understand. Real wages. That means at the end of every 10-year period, the average worker could buy more objects with his or her income than they could at the beginning of that decade. It went up. Prices didn't go up as much as the pay and wages went up. So for 150 years, the United States was able to pay its workers a rising real wage, a rising standard of living. No other capitalist country could boast that statistic. We were unique. It bred in this country a psychological assumption that if you work hard and go to school and do as you're told, you will be better off than your parents, who were better off than your grandparents, and you'll none of you be as well off as your children are certain to be. That wasn't craziness. That was a response to the truth, the reality, the exceptional reality of the American working class. That's where this idea came up that we are really an exceptional place, American exceptionalism. Wow, we were exceptional in that regard. Religious Americans, of whom I believe there are significant numbers, attributed this, of course, to the obvious, which is that God likes us better than he likes everybody else. Why else would he? And that was probably because we were better than everybody else. A comforting thought as you get closer to death. In any case, it bred in the American people an assumption, whether it was religiously interpreted or not. So now imagine with me, a people, us, used to, for 150 years of a rising standard of living, suddenly having the door slammed in our face, nice time, good time, happy history, all over. Gone, disappeared, no longer available. That's what we've lived through. That's what we are living through. This would be an experience that would disequilibrate any human being. More than enough to make you depressed. Oh, maybe not at the first couple of years. Then you simply said to yourself, hard times every now and then, and we'll get through it. Maybe after 5 or 10 years, well, lasting a long time, but we'll get through it. But after 20 or 30 years, despite an unbelievable effort of the society to help you to deny what's happening, it's no longer deniable. But the mechanisms of denial are very important. They always are in cases of depression, personal or economic. So we had a society that gave us ways to deny what we actually saw. There were several. Number one, and perhaps the most important, was the creation of the modern debt society. You're not going to be paid wages to enhance your standard of living, so we are going to give you loans. Oh boy, are we going to give you loans. And in order to do that, we have to overcome the 150 years, because part of the pride of the American people over 115 years, understandable, admirable pride, was that we were able to enjoy a higher standard of living without borrowing. We could hold on to those old Protestant virtues. Don't do that. Neither a lender nor a borrower be, as Mr. Shakespeare reminded us. Don't do it. Don't go there. It's bad. It's close to sinful. We didn't have to. So in order to get the American people to load up on debt, and let's remember, starting around the 1950s, the American people became a new kind of pioneer. Not in the wagons going across the prairies, not that kind. We took on a level of debt that no working class in the history of the world had ever taken on before. We became pioneers. Mortgage debt, car loan debt, credit card debt, and the best for the last, student debt. Student debt. We even figured out a way to make it impossible to get through college without loading up on what your parents already had too much of. Is it lunacy? No, no, this is the behavior of people who are depressed about their reality and can deny it and postpone it by using borrowed money to do what they no longer could afford. And so the American people became deaf, blind, and dumb. They acquired more and more debt on wages that went nowhere. You don't need to be a rocket scientist to understand you cannot accumulate more and more debt if the basic income with which you're going to pay it back isn't going anywhere. You keep doing that, and a day will come when, let's call it 2008, it all falls apart. You can't pay back, which any half-wit could have predicted. And many of us, being half-wits, did predict it. Because it's not very hard to predict. If you've learned the numbers and the curves, there we go, this is not going to last. This story doesn't end well. But I don't believe this was unknown. In fact, I know it wasn't. The people who accumulated debt worried about it. Think about yourselves. They noticed that those monthly statements from the credit card company, oh, a little footnote for those of you who like history. When did the credit card become a normal thing in this country? The 1970s. You think that's a coincidence? No. Before that, a credit card was something that a business person carried around. American Express was about it. It was the 1970s that the genius in the bank understood, let's fill the wallets of depressed Americans with as many pieces of plastic as we can cram in there. Because they're so upset about their inability to consume on a rising scale that they will borrow like crazy people, or maybe like severely depressed people. Because it's the only way to do what? To be an American. To capture the American dream. To fulfill the expectation of a rising standard of living that you had promised yourself, that your parents had promised you, and that you were busy promising your children. Of course you had to borrow, and Citibank figured it out. You were all patsies. They could get you to take credit cards. It was easy. Just send you 15 things in the mail. By the 13th, you fill it out. And you get another card to max out. What an amazing system. It fed first. It got you to accept an end to the rising standard of living in the 1970s. Yes, let's be honest amongst ourselves, even if it's called the Left Forum. And I give the same talk in places that are not left forums and would be horrified at the thought of a left forum. We accepted it. You did. I did. It's even worse. Like depressed people, we were glad to get the credit card. As if we preferred to have a rising standard of living by going into debt than the way we had had it for 150 years, which was without going into debt. To be grateful for being screwed is not a healthy sign. And it takes a lot in a modern society to have so pliant a mass of working class people. You have been had. That's the reality. But it was because you were depressed psychologically. And that was in turn because you have an economy that works this way. And why did it? I'll put my economics hat on. Because the American capitalist class, the people who own and operate the big businesses in this country, they had a kind of eureka moment in the 1970s. Remember in the comic books, there's a little box that, eureka, I figured something out. Well, these capitalists, none too smart a group, had a real exciting moment in the 1970s when they noticed two things. One, that there was a world out there beyond the United States which had a charming quality. While here in the United States for 150 years, the real wages had gone up, in the rest of the world, turns out, they hadn't. If you are a nasty mind, like mine, you would have probably figured out that the reason they could go up here had more than a little to do with the fact that they didn't go up anywhere else. In fact, often went down. But the eureka moment for capitalists was in this form. Why the hell are we producing goods and services here in the United States where we pay workers this, when if we moved it to China, we could pay workers, and I'm going to put my hand where you can't see it, to underscore much lower? Which is why all of you right now, with very few exceptions, are wearing underpants not made in this country. And don't look now, do that later. It applies to your overpants as well. And your shirts and your shoes and your gloves and, you know, pretty much everything else. That was done to save wages. Let's be real clear. You make more profits because the same object is produced by a worker to whom you pay much less. No rocket scientist here. That's why it was done. You know what that means in plain English? It means that to the working class, the following sentence was delivered. Drop dead. Who needs you? We're out of here. All we need you now to be is docile consumers, but producers, forget it. We're not interested in you as a producer. And not only are we going to take the job, but why should we be taxed, we big businesses, to pay for schools, to train workers we don't need? So we don't need fancy schools and expensive state colleges. We can have you all in a community college and in a voc ed program, or in no program, or in that special kind of educational program which we call prisons. American people understood this, even if they didn't admit it. Somewhere they got it. Somewhere there, they understood they were not wanted, not appreciated. If you lived in a place like, I don't know, Detroit or Cleveland or Camden or Youngstown or Topeka or all kinds of places, all you had to do is open your eyes as you walked through town and you'd realize that the workplaces were abandoned and the need for working people was gone. You were being replaced by cheaper workers someplace else. The businesses of this country had chosen to put their money someplace else, and so the bottom line to the American working men and women was, screw you, drop dead. We don't need you, we don't want you. Wow, what a nice feeling. Why would people get depressed? The question is, why didn't they get more depressed? Why didn't they get suicidal? Well, as you'll learn later, they did. They have. They went crazy. But the system had a temporary way of getting out of it, loading you up with debt, convincing you that it was okay to have the debt, the very way the Protestant ministers of America had worked so hard to make you think debt was the worst and last thing you should do for 150 years. Now you were proud to have lots of credit cards. It was normalized. You live on debt. Of course, it adds to your anxiety. Your job is insecure. You see them leaving everywhere. The benefits that go with jobs, they're starting to be eroded. The quality of the work, not anywhere so exciting. And now you have debt worries on top of your job. Of course you're getting depressed. The depression, the psychological depression, the denial, the fakery, faking yourself out as well as joining in the fakery of the culture, takes an enormous psychological toll, as anyone in the profession will tell you. And then it really crashed in 2008, and that sped the whole thing up. Of course, I should underscore, if I had more time, I would, that this 40 years, 70 to 2008, roughly, also had secondary effects. When the capitalist hires you to produce a good, you produce more value than the capitalist pays you. That's why he hires you. That's already depressing. Think about it. No, think about it seriously. You get hired for an hour. You get paid $20 for your hour of work. The employer knows that whatever you add to what he can sell by virtue of your hour of labor, you give him more goods at the end of the day to sell than he would have if he hadn't hired you. He's going to pay you $20. The only way he's ever going to do that is if during those 20 hours you add more to the value of what he has to sell at the end than the $20 he pays you, which means that the only way you ever get a job is if you produce more value than you get. Which means when you were young and naive and innocent and told yourself with great pride that you would never work for anybody who didn't pay you what you were worth, you're now depressed. As it slowly sinks into your head that that never happened, that your parents never understood what you now grasp, which is the name of the game in capitalism is you produce more than your employer pays you. Ha, 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 at your expense. Of course you're depressed. Of course you need happy hour at the end of the eight unhappy ones. Of course you do. Because you're depressed. And whether you find solace in alcohol or 27 other substitutes, what difference does it make? You are depressed. The last 40 years then finished you off in 2008. Now the whole thing fell apart, and you began to realize just how serious this all was. The banks were no longer willing to lend because you were a deadbeat. You were that kind of person who, having denied what was happening to them, borrowed too much without figuring out that can't last. Well, the banks have figured it out. It can't last. They made a bundle off of you, and on behalf of them, let me thank you all. But it's over now. And that's a double whammy, because the capitalists of this society made a lot of money by moving production to where it's cheap. And they made another bundle of money by lending you the money that they used to pay you in higher wages. And they got interest off of that, as you noticed. So they really did well. The gap between rich and poor in America over the last 40 years went crazy. That's why in 2011 we could have a movement in America, a profound new movement, the first one in 50 years that put the economic inequality right up front. Occupy Wall Street, the 1% against the 99. That's the end result of 40 years of income inequality getting worse and worse. 40 years ago, the United States was markedly less unequal than most of the countries of Europe. We are now number one. We've outranked them all. It's worse here than in any European country. Wow! What an achievement. So you're falling further and further behind. You know that. Some of you know that if you go to Madison Park there in mid-Manhattan, there's a terribly impressive, tiny, narrow building that rises way above everybody else. That's where Rupert Murdoch lives, on the top three floors there. He paid about $23, $24 million to be able to look down on everybody else. That's not lost on everybody else. Even if you don't make it conscious, unconscious, you get it. You get it. This morning's New York Times brings an advertisement for the Hudson Yards, the great new ritzy development not very many blocks from here, western part of Manhattan. And the glossy magazine fold out in today's New York Times tells you wonderful apartments from the low end to the high end. The low end, $3.5 million. And you can enjoy Hudson Yards. Oh, well, let me correct that. None of you can enjoy that. It's not for you. And you know that. And to think that that doesn't bother you, that's called denial. Of course it bothers you. Have 100 of those every day, that bothers you more. You are depressed. In the time that I have left, which isn't much, let me talk about the other way. What happens if people are depressed? All kinds of interesting things happen to them. One, they stop spending money the way they did before. It's a serious problem of the American economy. We cannot recover from 2008, and one of the major reasons is the mass of American consumers are not spending money. And that's because they're scared to death and they're depressed. It's very serious. You know what else happens? Workers do not go to work with whatever idea of being productive they once had because they're too depressed. And the productivity of the United States economy has been limping along for decades now. And when everyone's scratching their head, why would that be? We give these workers more and more training. We give them lots of fancy machines. Yeah, but they're depressed. And so they don't work the machines the way they once did. They don't have the attitude. They don't have the spirit. It's very expensive to depress your working class and very politically dangerous. So let me end on that. When workers are depressed because the economy depresses them, where do they go? What do? Well, they go in lots of different directions. One, they can become suicidal. They can become reliant on drugs and alcohol. They can resign themselves to their fate. They can lose all interest in everything and anything. That often happens. But it's not the only reaction. They can become very bitter. They can look at the whole society and say, this is not helping me. Or, to make a long story short, they can become anti-establishment. They can become enraged. They don't even know exactly why, because they haven't followed all of this and nobody's explained it to them. But they know that they want to give a particular finger on one of their hands to the establishment in their country. And all they need is an opportunity. Let the establishment say you should do X, and with great glee, they'll do not X. First example, in England, a trivial issue abused by the ruling class for years, that everything bad that happens in England is because we're part of Europe, and everything good about Europe is here in England. Typical nationalist junk. The ruling class says, hey, let's have a vote, figuring they had it in the bag. Let's stay in Europe or not. And the working class gives them the finger, votes to leave Europe. The working class knows, it does, that being in or out of Europe is not their issue, not their problem, will not solve anything. Leaves the same people in power who were in power before. But it was a chance to give that finger. So they took it. The election in this country in 2016 did the same. Somebody said, I'm against all of this. I don't care about all of this. I'm going to screw it all over. I'm going to change everything. I'm the new dad. You want to give the finger to everybody? Vote for me. And they did, didn't they? And he makes a practice of putting that finger up as often as possible to keep the finger people happy. Did you read how he withdrew from the Paris Accords? America, we're not going to be told what to do by those foreign people over there. Wonderful. But there's also buried in here, and this is my last thing, a fantastic opportunity. Because the enemy of the mass of people, what has gotten them depressed economically and psychologically, is this economic system that works this way, that responds to workers who struggled for 150 years to get higher wages by saying, see ya, we're going to where the wages are low, we're taking it all away from you. Their workers know that. And if there were a movement in this country that could address the depression that people feel and help them understand where it comes from and why they're suffering it, then they wouldn't be looking for fake ways of pushing back, giving the finger to what doesn't matter, and allowing ridiculous morons into political power. Wouldn't be necessary. They wouldn't get lost in the symbolism. They might go after the real thing. That's an opportunity we have, and it would be a horrible tragedy if we didn't see that another way of explaining to people and sharing with people the feelings of being depressed, validating those. You have every right to be depressed about this, but here is a solution, would be one hell of a better way to respond, which they're going to understand more and more in the weeks and months ahead, because what they did in England to vote for Brexit and what we did here to vote for Trump will solve none of what I have talked to you about, and therefore the depression will continue. And when those solutions fail, maybe those that come out of things like a left forum will prove that they have a better shot at it. Thank you.
That just hits really close to home, doesn't it? I'm very, very excited to introduce our next panelist, Dr. Harriet Fraud. She is a mental health counselor and hypnotherapist in private practice here in New York City. She's a founding member of the feminist movement and the journal Rethinking Marxism. She's a monthly guest on Economic Update with Richard Wolff and is a longtime radical who writes extensively on the intersection of the U.S. economy and personal life. Her latest contribution to a book will appear in August 2017 in Knowledge and Class: Marxism Without Guarantees. And you can learn more about her on her website, HarrietFraud, FRAAD.com. Welcome, Harriet.
Capitalist misery, economy meets psychology, and they hug each other. Economic conditions, social conditions, and mental health are as intimately connected as Siamese twins. There are clear signs of this relationship as we look around. They all point to the fact that the mass of U.S. citizens are economically, socially, and psychologically in very bad shape. I'll briefly look at these three areas: social conditions, mental health, and economic conditions, and show how they relate to each other. I'll also look at how these factors play out in the daily lives of Americans. Let's start first with economic conditions, not because they're the most important, but because they're relevant too, and that's what I decided. The new word for proletariat in the United States should be the precariat. In their economic lives and their personal lives and their family lives, Americans now live precariously at the brink of disaster. Economically, only 37% of Americans have $500 to tide them over in an emergency. Almost half, 46%, can't cover an emergency that costs even $400. If we break a tooth, if we get picked up for some minor infraction, like stealing a pair of sneakers, we can't cover the bail cost of $500, we could end up in Rikers and be tortured. The minimum recommended by the experts that we should set aside to cover an emergency, like being fired from a job or having a serious health issue, is 3 months of living expenses. Most Americans are in fact one paycheck from the street. That's why when you look around Manhattan, you see those people who didn't have that paycheck, a lot of homeless people. In their personal and their family lives, Americans are not doing much better. They can't necessarily turn to friends for help because one in four Americans has no friends, They have no one to turn to, even in the case of a dire emergency, no one to talk to, no less a person from whom they could borrow money. Families can't any longer necessarily help. Half of the people in America can't turn to their families or their friends for emotional help or financial help. The economic and psychological anchor cables that tied American personal life to a secure foundation and gave people a sense of well-being are seriously frayed and breaking. What happened? In brief, in the 1970s, sophisticated multinational communication systems allowed jobs to be outsourced easily to places that are low pay, with no ecological protections that cost money, and no personal rights either. The whole world became exploitable by American corporations, seeing a wonderful profit and thinking of nothing else, which they're not supposed to. After all, that's business. Under capitalism, they outsourced millions and millions of jobs to China, India, Pakistan, other nations where they could reap huge profits. For example, the Chinese workers making Ivanka's Trump's apparel earn about 44 cents a day, and she's now outsourced her shoe production to Africa, where they make even less. Pakistani workers work in the usual industries, work on average for $2 a day. Outsourcing to the whole world was a treat for capitalism. Well, now the view from the rest of us, the 99%, or at least the 80%, without well-paying family wage jobs that used to be available to white men when whites were actually a large majority, the vast majority of white men began to get had a family wage that allowed them to support dependent wife and children and have a decent middle class life. Minorities and women never got that privilege. They could never sustain a middle class family's life. But when white male wages froze because their jobs were exported overseas, where there's no unions, no ecological protections, no work benefits, white families were stuck, and white women had to join their minority sisters and go into the labor force. Even with two incomes, wages were too low to make it into the American dream of a better life for each generation, a dream which, as Rick said, was available for whites between 1820 and the 1970s. When women worked outside the home and brought in a good deal of income, they were no longer happy to then go home, take care of men, take care of children, and take care of the home. That was too much. For men, that was a privilege of manhood. Often the unemployed man does less housework than his fully employed wife because he's recouping his manhood. And at the very top, in a recent study, it's quite interesting. When women make a good deal more than their husbands, which they do about 30% of the time, they do even more to compensate their men for the loss of manhood in their making a higher wage. So, even if they wanted to, they couldn't do the same amount of labor after work that they'd done full time. Home life began to splinter. Marriages could not be sustained. People didn't want to get married in the first place. Now it's women who refuse marriage, and 65% of the divorces are now initiated by women. If they marry, the fastest growth of kind of couple is married people who decide not to have children. Most children in America will grow up without their biological parents, because 42% are born outside of a marriage anyway, because women may want to take care of children, but they don't want to take care of men too. so personal life is now precarious, as well as economic life is precarious. Everything is shaking. These are the results of capitalist outsourcing, for which they are utterly unaccountable. They're the results that Trump is trying to shift to the people who started to be empowered at the same time as the jobs were exported, minorities and women. This was the white America that was a majority that Trump is trying to recreate, as if it was whiteness that determined higher wages, rather than that there was a scarce labor market in which white males were highly prioritized. It's not scarce anymore. You have the whole world to exploit. Where people still have a job, the working conditions have deteriorated sharply. There was an article about working at Victoria's Secret, and they asked, do you get any benefits? She said, yes. One free bottle of perfume and two bras. That's it. And her work hours, like for many Americans, their work hours are cut, so they have the precarity of never knowing what they can count on for income. With the huge profits that American corporations made, they bought our politicians, they also bought our media, and so that their message and looking at the world through their eyes became common sense. It became what we learned. In fact, it wasn't until 2011 when Occupy sort of pointed out, hey, class counts here. There's the 99% and the 1%, that people began to catch on. In 1970, America was the most equal, the most egalitarian in terms of income of all the nations in the industrialized Western world. Now we are the least of all. We've come a long way. Now that obviously impacts both emotional life and economic life. According to very meticulously researched reports, and if anybody's interested in the footnotes, they can see me afterwards. They're boring to recite. And a very important report by the World Health Organization, inequality is a disaster for mental health. There are 9 major costs of inequality. One is the level of trust between people is eroded. Another is mental illness and addiction, which is part of a mental illness way, part of a solution that some people find to mental illness. Third is social bonds, which begin to fray, because of course you need trust for those, eating disorders and obesity. And we are the fattest country of all the industrialized nations. In some states, like West Virginia, which has lost a lot of jobs, they have to make double-wide coffins and they have to have derricks to lower people into their graves, which, and their graves are opened sooner than they would have been otherwise, because we are also losing life expectancy in the United States, which is another one. Still another is homicides and mass murders, suicides. Another is imprisonment rates, which we have the highest in the world, and loss of social mobility. The U.S. is the world leader in each of those areas. I'll only look at 3 because they present very new and very current ways of dealing with the pain of inequality. One is mental illness and addiction. Another is homicides and mass murder. And the third is lack of trust. And each is a unique view on what's happening. First, mental illness. 1 in 5 Americans is taking at least one psych drug. We're only 5% of the world's population, and we're taking over 66% of the world's psych drugs. There are at least 3 reasons why. One, that people's hopes for economic and personal stability and happiness are dashed. They're lost and sad. They don't know what to do. They don't have a movement that helps them. Another is that instead of reaching out to join with others to change things, they've lost their trust and become depoliticized and isolated. A third is capitalist marketing, the case of drugs and mental illness. We are the only Western nation that allows direct-to-consumer advertising. No other Western industrialized nation allows that. We also lead the world in the kind of market-driven healthcare that rewards doctors with money for prescribing brand-name drugs. For example, the average doctor gets at least $30,000 a year for having little seminars to which a trade representative comes, where they tout to other doctors the wonderful benefits of prescribing a drug. A great example is from the Harvard Child Psychiatry Department, of which Dr. Biederman was the head, and he also was the head of the Child Psychiatry Association. He wrote extensively on the safety of extending the very profitable antipsychotic Zyprexa drug, extending that to use for children. Of course, it did give children diabetes and did not cure their mental illness, but he got $3.5 million for himself to set up a special center for Dr. Biederman. And when asked, one of his staff was asked, hey, he did get fined $3.5 million. No, I'm sorry, that was $3 million. And when asked, when one of his staff was asked, well, you got the biggest fine we've ever given. Why didn't that stop you from doing this? And the guy said, hey, if you're racing towards $17 billion, you pay the traffic ticket. That's what they made off Zyprexa. Another way that people look for refuge in their misery is with a self-prescription, an addiction. At this time, America is in the throes of a serious addiction problem with heroin, opiates, and opioids. Opiates are heroin, a natural organic drug, and opioids are synthetics, pain pills, and so on. Drug overdose is now the leading cause of accidental death in the United States, ahead of car accidents or shootings. There are even more opiate and opioid deaths than any other kind. What does that say? Who's using and who's dying now? Drug addiction used to be an epidemic that was associated with African Americans who had no chance to move upwards, who were depressed because their mobility was frozen, and the inner city. Now the suburbs are the inner city. Now the epidemic is white. It affects just those who have been devastated by their loss of the American dream. Suburban people who used to be in the middle class, rural whites who used to have thriving farms, and also children who see no hope for the future. It affects the young man who had hoped to inherit his mom's mom and pop diner, which is now McDonald's, Pizza Hut, Friendly's, etc. The couple who planned to take over their local grocery store, shoe store, food store, which is now all Walmart. The blue-collar rural worker who's a painter or a carpenter whose livelihoods are stolen by corporate America running huge businesses. Or the middle-aged white man who had looked forward to retirement was fired shortly before he retired, so he doesn't have to get anything. Here too, Big Pharma contributed. Most heroin users begin with prescribed drugs, which are, as I showed you the example before, aggressively marketed to doctors. Prescribing rates for painkillers have doubled in spite of the addiction warnings. There are enough prescription drugs for opiates to give every American his or her own bottle of pills. 48,000 American women have died in the last 5 years of painkiller overdoses, because women are more likely to get pain medication than be in chronic pain. It's very interesting the way this works. I had a client when I worked elsewhere who was an elderly woman living in an elder complex. And every month, the drug dealer would come by, because she was on disability. She could barely make ends meet with her Social Security and disability. And every month, the drug dealer would come by and offer her $15 a pill for the pain pills she got for free, which then he sold for $45 and $50. And he worked through the whole complex, and so people would have some discretionary income. The pharmaceutical companies worked hard to get past permission to issue oxycodone. People fought it because OxyContin became a highly abused drug that was responsible for boarding up all the drug stores and huge crime sprees, particularly in the South. The consumers lost. Psychopharma won. They had the money to bribe the legislators. Capitalism plays its part in this heroin addiction. In addition, and this opiate and opioid addiction, and most people go on to heroin after they've been prescribed pain pills and then run out because heroin is cheaper, street heroin. Americans are suffering. Advertising giants and a corrupt, market-driven healthcare system converts their suffering into profits. Pills can't solve their problems. They can affect brain chemistry, but so can therapy or getting involved in a political organization. And those solutions, getting involved or getting therapy, do not result in being comfortably numb. They don't usurp the brain's own power to soothe and solve its own problems, to self-soothe, the way pills do. Pills do make a huge profit. Here again, capitalism shows its bloody hand. A second cost of inequality, which I'll look at, is homicide. Here again, America leads the developed world. Don't say we're not leaders. Part of that deluge of violence is from our uniquely unchecked gun use and gun sales. Americans are 20 times more likely to die from guns than any other developed nation. The marketing agents for the gun lobby had a very smart idea. Instead of saying, buy guns, make the gun producers rich, they've converted to buy guns, recapture your lost manhood, your Second Amendment rights to stand up for yourself. And this is at a point where the male gender is feeling assailed by low wages and feeling as if their rights are robbed. Manhood and rights are smarter advertisements than just make us rich. Their lobbying enhances the daily slaughter from guns. Mass murder has a particularly American twist, and that involves killing two or three people at the same time, people with whom one has no contact. That's mass murder. It doesn't count the many millions who kill their girlfriends or their whole family, etc. The last time I studied that was September of 2017, I guess September of 2016. In that month, no wealthy nation except the U.S. had any killings, and we had 30 mass killings. The killers were all American men who were either disappointed in their love lives or had lost jobs or both. They were unmanned within traditional gender stereotyped manhood, and they reclaimed their manhood in a blaze of murderous glory. The murders began, mass murder began in the 1980s under Reagan, when union busting became something that the president was involved in, and where corporations were boosted over the rest of us through lower taxes for them, higher for us, and anti-union and anti-worker drives. They're a symptom of American inequality and corporate capitalist dominion. A third area of the mental health disaster and its resulting capitalist inequality is lack of trust. This will be the last one. I think it's safe to say that the majority of Americans no longer trust our government, something which Trump capitalizes on. They also, sadly, don't trust any collective organization, except for Bernie Sanders, they seem to, who is still the most popular politician, even though he was knifed in the back by the Democrats there. They don't really trust any organization that wants their active participation. They can't even trust their intimate partners, and they also can't trust themselves anymore. And I'll talk briefly about each area of trust that I mentioned. Trust in government. A good way to explore at least minimal trust in government is to look at the minimal participation that wealthy nations offer, which is voting. Among these wealthy nations, the U.S. has the lowest number of eligible voters that actually turn out for elections. In our last presidential election, 55%, 5% more than half of people had enough trust that their voice made a difference that they voted. In contrast, in Belgium, instead of 55%, they had 87% turnout. Denmark, Sweden, and Norway had 80% turnout. That's good. Other wealthy nations like France and Germany had at least 70%. By the way, in the U.S., only one of these nations allows corporate donations for elections. In the others, it's not allowed. And if they're caught, they're punished and they can't run. That happened to a German recently. Almost half of Americans may perceive that their government is bought, and so they no longer have a voice. They don't trust it. They've given up the little influence that was left to them. That was clearly illustrated in the last election, where millennials turned out for Bernie Sanders. 175,000 volunteered the first week of the Bernie campaign. People felt they were empowered. When Bernie's was stabbed in the back, millennials lost the trust that they could make a difference and didn't turn out. Half of them didn't bother. Americans became disconnected when corporate America took over in the 70s. That's when people withdrew. They stopped trusting participation. In 1970, there were more people involved in bowling leagues alone than are involved in any political, social, or recreational association after 2000. People need to trust in collective effort to join a group. Part of the reason we don't is we're barraged by lies. Advertising is everywhere, promising benefits of beauty and happiness it won't deliver. The beer shows you connected with handsome, sexy people on a boat or something, at a picnic. The Coke that can kill you the medications to which you become addicted, the cars that show you the power to be in the driver's seat when you're not. We're surrounded by lies. We've lost our trust even in the closest relationships. The fastest growing kind of U.S. household is people living alone. As Eric Kleinenberg, in his best-selling book, Going Solo, The Extraordinary Rise and Surprising Appeal of Living Alone, says, for the first time in U.S. history, the majority of women are single and by choice. More and more people remain unmarried. Half that marry divorce. They can't accomplish a co-respective and sustaining relationship. The fastest growing kind of couple that is actually married and stays there for a while has no children. They don't want children because they can't trust that they could provide for themselves no less an utterly dependent life. Within this precarious America, it's too scary. There's an even more damaging level of trust, which is closely related to mental illness. Americans have lost trust in themselves to make the kind of work and love and political lives that are hopeful and positive. Capitalist advertising thrives on shaming us about who we are, how we smell, how we look, whether we're aging. They present models that are touched up to create impossible standards for us that we fail to meet. If you feel X, take Y. Of course, Y doesn't deliver. It's interesting that Lena Dunham's series on HBO, Girls, was so popular, much more popular than they expected, because the women who are presented are not necessarily pretty or thin or free of mental problems. That was a huge relief and excitement for Americans because we were out from under the standards we can't meet. Self-confidence is eroded for at least the 80% of us whose basic lives are economically precarious and who find it very hard to find a fulfilling, stable life and future. People become afraid to even try. They lack trust across the board. How can we restore that trust? That's what we need to worry about. That trust in ourselves, in each other, and in banding together to make a better future. There are lots of things that I believe in. And within all of this dysfunction, there is one set of connections that has thrived in America. In every little town where you don't find anything, not even a church, you have an AA meeting. That's 12-step programs, which are organized very interestingly along socialistic or communist principles. We can learn. They thrive outside of a money economy. There are no authoritative leaders who are not responsible or accountable to the group. Every voice counts. Why does it work? Well, it requires members to at first acknowledge they have a problem. You can't say, I am Harriet and she's an alcoholic. That won't work. You have to acknowledge you have to have a problem. It elicits from all of its members the admission that they can't solve their problems all alone, that they need the group. And AA or any of the other A's let them know they can't solve it alone, but with the group and the connection with the group, they can solve it. The 12-step programs recognize and incorporate the importance, above all, of connection. The famous story of Bill W. starting AA, he was told if he got drunk again, he'd die. So he went to a guy he knew in a church and he said, get me another smart alcoholic. I got to connect and solve this. And it was he who, in his last, one of his last letters in 1958, said, our next future is in emotional sobriety and connection. It's not just the substance, it's the emotional connection that we need. Members listen to, validate, and honor each other's stories. Given the popularity of these programs, we could adapt that model to overcome the passivity and denial of the American people brought on by these tough times, so they can participate in our programs with mentors, with kind people to guide them through, with the group belief in connection, with listening to each other and knowing this is the program that addresses each other's and our concern. That's what we have to do. We have to follow the steps in our own way, where we admit that no one person alone can solve the problem, the chronic economic and societal problems we have, or the private ones, that only a collective will do, that we need to commit some of our time and energy and belief in a future to help each other. And these are variations of the 12 steps. That we look at a serious moral measure of ourselves, how we've colluded in the things that hurt us, how our nation has colluded by erasing the genocide and slavery on which it was developed, which isn't to give us guilt, but to make us understand and reach for each other. We've admitted to ourselves the ways we've been victims and victimizers without huge guilt trip. And we're going to work beyond the dysfunctional patterns of isolation and give each other the much needed support and help to help us unlearn the collusion that we've had and reach out and connect, which is crucial for our, very crucial for our mental health and our financial health. So I think that is an avenue to pursue, to rebuild ourselves and rebuild our hope and rebuild our connections and repossess our country.
Thank you very much, Harriet. All the reason for the precariat to stick together. So a recent study from the University of Zurich studied the correlation between unemployment and suicide rates and attributed 1 in 5 suicides worldwide to unemployment. They also found, interestingly, that suicide rates increase in the 6 months before a rise in unemployment. And the same study also found that the suicide risk is much stronger in countries where unemployment is uncommon. What factors contribute to these findings?
Well, the 6 months before is when people are afraid to be unemployed. I had a client who was the last one in what had been a floor of 30 designers. And he couldn't stand it. He quit because the anxiety level of feeling that somebody's going to get the axe and it's going to be him next was too much. So I think that's one of the reasons.
At the risk of talking about economics more than anyone should be asked to tolerate, let me anyway suggest. Economists believe in a bizarre ritual, which is called cost-benefit analysis. You have to suspend all rational faculties to become engaged in this, even though there are thousands of people across the United States who are paid and paid well to do this. Here's how it works. You count the costs of a potential action, and you count the benefits. And the rule is, if the benefits add up to more than the costs, well, why then you do it. And if they don't, you don't. So it's an action rule. Sounds perfectly reasonable, doesn't it? And you can get paid big bucks, especially if you have the right degrees, to do such studies for companies that are thinking about building a new wing on their factory, or buying a fleet of trucks, or a hospital designing deciding whether or not to have a children's wing, or the president deciding whether to bomb Syria, or whatever the issue is that you're thinking about. You have people who come in and do cost-benefit analysis. And it, as every practitioner of this ritual knows, the people who hire you can tell you what they want as an outcome, which they usually do, and then you can count costs and benefits to achieve the outcome that they have paid you to do. It's very unwise to come up with a result that they don't pay you to do, because that's the last time they will hire you. This is a ritual that is lost on nobody who participates in this, unless you are under 19 years of age and have never done it before. Here's what this unemployment related to suicide teaches us. I've never seen, and I've read many of them, cost-benefit analysis of a program that takes into account A, when there might be unemployment, and B, what the cost is, no easy matter to determine, of suicide to the people involved who are now dead, to their family, friends, relations, codependents, and so on. In other words, capitalism as a system justifies what it does on the criteria of the efficiency. But of course, it's only efficient depending on what you count. And by not counting the suicide, 1 out of 5 suicides are related to unemployment, which we all know, which we've known for decades. Maybe not the exact number, but the reality. It's a wonderful cautionary tale why the claim to efficiency should always be understood to raise the question, what in the world did you count? And if you really pursue that, then you reach an even more disturbing understanding. The costs and benefits of any action are infinite. They last into an unknowable future. And therefore, the claim to have counted all the costs and benefits of an action is a claim by a person who needs a great deal of mental help, because it is no more doable than flying over this building, and no amount of higher education will enable you to do it. It's a very important thing to understand, because it's as vital as life and death to not have counted it and not even understand it.
So I'd like to bring up the racial aspect of this topic. I'd love to hear about how the economic crisis has affected the rise of white supremacy and separatist groups and hate crimes towards minority populations. And of course, we can all speculate as to why that happened, but can you speak to the psychological process that may lead people to join these groups?
If you go back to what I said in my opening remarks, I think I can pick up on that. If you've depressed the American working class, you've taken away the job security, the job benefits, you've stagnated their wages, you've deprived them of the American dream that they thought they were entitled to and would be having, you've taken away an enormous amount of what is their identity, what is their sense of self, who they are, what they have achieved, how they can walk among their friends and neighbors. And when you've taken away a great deal from a person, that's a moment of enormous vulnerability. And they are vulnerable to being told, well, there is something you still have. There is something you can cleave to. There is a way that you still are an important person. Because you're white. Because you're an American. And then begins the process of suggesting how important it is to get back to those things, because they haven't been taken from you yet. And they become all the more important because so much has. So for me, I'm not surprised at a Trump, the symbol of all of this. It's going to give you back your important Americanness, your important whiteness, your whatever there is that you still have, because they've taken away everything. It's like a cartoon I once saw in which one bird snatches everything else of the other bird, its nest, its eggs, its children, its partner. and then teaches it to admire the wonderful colors of the straws in what's left of the nest. That's the game. Celebrate what is left from those from whom you've taken everything else, rather than have them be angry about all that was taken from them. That's why in the end, the slogan of the left has to be to teach those who are left with the symbols, American, white, and so on, that their better shot is to ally with the people they're being set against, and together they might make a real change. But going in this route not only sets them against one another, but keeps them without the very things taken from them that brought them to this sorry situation in the first place.
I also think that we have to understand that Trump is an outgrowth of Bill Clinton and Obama and the neoliberal establishment. For some reason, they don't want to be regarded as the basket of deplorables. Surprising. These are the elites, the educated, who have looked down upon them, who have looked at their unhappy conditions and blamed their stupidity, who've mocked their speech, and they're very angry. And Trump gives them back their identity as supreme, white supremacy, instead of being degraded and reviled. So, you know, and what's understandable, because everything is, isn't forgivable. But it can be understood and understandable.
So as we know, these issues are not limited to the United States. These are issues that affect workers and citizens of every country worldwide. What have other nations done to support and cure the social and personal miseries of their citizens during economic depressions?
Unfortunately, many countries have done exactly what Mr. Trump is doing. That's where he got many of the ideas. Steve Bannon and other people can help him to understand. And you all know what's going on around the world. Half the countries of Europe, if not more, are wrestling with immigrant populations whom they are designating as inferiors and the causes of their problem. The left in Europe has been split, not knowing exactly how to respond to all of this. But I think the majority, particularly now it's becoming clear, have made the decision, not knowing yet how exactly to do it, but to basically say what history itself is teaching, that like loading Americans up with debt, it didn't solve the problem of a working class that is being destroyed. It just postponed the moment of it. And the same is true with turning the mass of the working class in Europe against the immigrants. Because whatever you do with those immigrants will not solve your problem. And sooner or later, the perception that whatever we say or do isn't about to solve our problem, that creates the opening for the left to say, yes, because your problem never was the presence of these people here. Your problem was the same system that destroyed their homelands, which is why they come here in the first place, and which is now going to use them against you as it has been doing for decades and will continue. You can't solve this problem, and if you throw them out, this is the system that will automate away your job or move your job. You know, I've been in many capitalist corporation board meetings where I listen to the members of the board, and you know what they debate? They debate this. As long as we can get away with it with the mass of people, we'll move the jobs to where the cheap labor is. And when the revolt against globalization happens, we'll bring the cheap labor here, because the issue is just the cheap labor. We don't give a happy damn where it is. The left worries, stop. It's the system that's going to stick it to you one way or another. And if you were able to block it, If you were able to block the low-wage immigrant in, and you were able to block the globalization, the moving out, they always have the last one. That's called automation. They'll replace you with a robot or a computer. That's the way the system works. You don't deal with that. You go round and round and round dealing with one or another of their escape mechanisms, simply making them move to yet another one. That's why the system is the problem.
All right, final question, Harriet, this is for you. You've talked about how the crisis has affected women. What effect does this have on children and families affected by the crisis? And what can men and women do to feel connected mentally in times of economic hardship?
Well, unfortunately, our society puts the entire burden on parents. And so children are in terrible, terrible shape. They're the poorest people in America. The poorest adults are single mothers, the poorest people are children. And over one in four is living in poverty and also has food scarcity, which means hunger. It's their fancier word for it. So children are in very bad shape. Also, since there isn't after school care and summer care, children are shut in their apartments. And the only activity they have is homebound, and they are obese. One in 13 American children is obese, which gives them a tendency to have heart disease and diabetes and hypertension. Children are in terrible shape. They're neglected, and they're also drugged. One in 10 is taking drugs. The drug Ritalin was sued, the drug makers, because they with the doctors that said it was necessary, because that whole hyperactive thing is crap. Kids need to move. They're not supposed to sit there all the time. If you ever go to a teacher's meeting, they're fidgeting around, they're talking, they're writing notes to each other. Nobody wants to just sit and shut up and listen. And drugging them was a way of accomplishing that. And it's a perfect example of the way capitalism works. Because although they were sued, it was still more profitable. So now one in 10 kids is taking medications. And another example of how this works is that the National Institutes of Mental Health came out and condemned the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, which all psychiatrists use to create a disorder or a psychiatric problem and then medicate it. They said, that's not right. It doesn't deal with the origin of the problem. Doesn't matter. The advertising revenues are there, and it continues, because that's the logic of capitalism.
Let's give a round of applause for